David Cobb is a college basketball and college football writer at CBS Sports, also a role player here at 92.9 FM ESPN, Monday, Wednesday, Friday with me here on the Gabe Kuhn Show. And then on Thursday, he is the company for Jeffrey Wright and Company on X David W. Cobb. David, how's it going? Happy Friday.
Hey, happy Friday, man. It looks like I skipped town just in time to miss a monsoon.
Yes. Yes. We have the tournament all shut down for the time being. But when'd you leave?
Yeah, headed out this morning. I was so disappointed because I spent most of July in Memphis, and I had to leave the weekend of the golf tournament, which is like one of my favorite things to do in Memphis. It's every year. I mean, I don't even care how hot it is. I love going to that golf tournament, and then I couldn't go this year. So I'm kind of salty about that. Although I'm sure the folks who are out there today are not having the best
They're
time.
Taking cover. They're taking cover right now. They're inside.
I would
trees,
think so. These videos are crazy, though. I mean, have you seen the clips on Twitter? There's rain coming into the hospitality.
I have not. I have not gotten to. I haven't gotten to look at that.
Yeah, it's like a biblical flood out there, it looks like. So, man, I hope people are staying safe. And I don't know if it's still like this, but back in the day, like, I mean, a lot of times you ended up parking on the grass out there. That could get real swampy. Anyway, yeah, I hope everything logistically works out there at Southwind. But, yeah, anyway, that just looks like a crazy situation.
Speaking of golf, Penny Hardaway was playing golf earlier this week before the FedEx St. Jude Championship, and he did his sort of annual press run with all the reporters. They come ask him questions, and it feels like every single year he makes the claim that he's going to add to this roster at the FedEx St. Jude Championship Pro-Am. It feels like just about every single year he does that. But he says he wants to add two guys to the front court. Listen, I said this yesterday, and I mean it, and I wish I didn't, but I am kind of doom and gloom about this team this year. Not just because the Sincere Parker case – not just because they don't have any continuity, not just because the front court is thin. It just feels like there has been a lot of moving pieces and a fair amount of drama. And if we've learned anything from the Penny Hardaway tenure, that's never a good sign heading into a season. It just isn't.
Yeah, no, I heard you and Connor open the show on that yesterday. And I was like, man, Gabe's not feeling super optimistic. And I get it. I kind of am there with you on a lot of this. And I don't know when I hear him say that they want to add one or two more bigs. I agree that they need to. My question is, where are you going to find them?
Yes, what does that look like
at this point in the calendar? Yeah, exactly. I mean, because international guys are still available. They got Simon Mahawk, but it's so late in the process because I mean, I've written about what it's like for the international dynamic is something I've been plugged in on this summer, and it's such a long process to get your student visa approval, to get admitted to the university, to have the NCAA review your eligibility. I mean, like, for example, North Carolina has a guy, Luka Bogavic, who I think is just now getting here, when he's been essentially committed to North Carolina for months. I mean, these things take a long time, and that's your best bet. When you're talking about adding players at this point in the calendar, it's the international guys. And so I would think if you're going to go that route, at this point, you're probably more likely talking about somebody who gets here and enrolls for the spring. I would think if that's where they're going to look, and I don't know where else you would look at this point, that's what it's probably got to be, is an international guy who shows up in the spring. Or, maybe there's some 2026 reclass guys out there. But it's getting awfully late, man. It's getting awfully late to make that call to reclass. And I don't know if the guys who could do that are guys who could really help you, because we know how rare it is for freshmen to really help a lot, especially in the front court. And if you're talking about a guy who's reclassing, unless his name is Jalen Duren, man, I don't know. So, yeah, I mean, those front court concerns are very real, very, very real.
Yeah, they're very real, and I just feel like even beyond that, it's kind of an incomplete team. Like three-point production, I'm very curious about. Point production in general, if Sincere Parker's not able to go, like who is that leading scorer? Is it Doug McDaniel? Doug McDaniel averaged 12 points per game last year, took a step back. The offense And those questions, to me, are also pretty apparent outside of the front court, which is pretty obvious. That's the most glaring issue.
Yeah. I mean, okay, so I can try to paint you a positive picture, right? Because, like, when I write about a team, like, we're doing this roster series right now, and I wrote about Florida today, and I tried to paint, like a pessimistic outlook and a positive outlook. Like, if things go bad, here's what it looks like. If things go really well, here's what it looks like, you know? And so for Memphis, like, it could go bad for all the reasons we're discussing, a lack of depth in the front court, no clear scoring hierarchy, suspect three-point shooting. Like, all those things are very real concerns. But I think the positive outcome or positive outlook is, okay, you got a ton of guards and a ton of athletes, so you can play mega fast. You can go full court pressure all game long. You can kind of play positionless basketball because you don't really have a choice because you don't have any back-to-basket right. sort of bigs that – You know, so like, and then you know, that's the way you play. You just out athlete and just pressure to death everybody in the American. And heck, maybe some of these teams in November, December aren't really ready for that either. You know, like, obviously, Sincere Parker in that situation, it would be great if there was a resolution there that for Memphis that could allow him to continue to play basketball. If so, you know, then like there's some upside there with this team in terms of the sheer volume of guards and wings. When you talk about a Curtis Givens III and a Zachary Davis and a, you know, a Quante Berry. And if you're able to add or keep Sincere Parker in that group, like, that's a hefty amount of perimeter firepower there, you know, not to mention, you know, Doug McDaniel and whatnot. So it's, you know, that's the positive outlook, is that they could roll pretty deep on the perimeter. They could pressure you in sure. waves throughout the entirety of the game, and just sort of suffocate some teams that don't have as much talent. I think in the American that could maybe work.
Sure.
So there's your, you know, there's your positive outlook for how things could play out.
When you play small like that, and you play very perimeter based, though, when teams don't let you turn them over as much, you're going to have some 3-point shooting, and they have some guys that I think could be solid from the 3-point line, but that's not a strength of this team in this roster that's been put together. I feel like if you're going to play small positionless, you have to have some shooting, and I'm not sure that that's something that I'm very confident in.
Actually, yeah, I would concur. You know, you hope that, like, Doug McDaniel transferring down. I mean, when I say down, like, I would say Memphis and Kansas State are programs with comparable tradition and comparable aspirations,
but it's Big 12 to the American.
Transferring down in league. Yeah, so I don't want to be misinterpreted there, but, like, you know, you transfer down in competition in the league, and maybe he can shoot the three ball a little better. I don't know. Julius Thedford showed some promise last year at Western Kentucky. He was also banged up. And Curtis Givens III. I mean, honestly, those are two Memphis guys that have a lot of eligibility remaining who showed some flashes last season. Now they're coming home. Like, I'm really curious to see what they can provide. I think if you're looking for guys who could connect with the program, connect with the city, in a way that Memphis basketball teams really don't seem to anymore, like, there's your ticket there. Like, if I were Penny Hardaway or whatever, I'd be having the multimedia video team at Memphis follow those guys around their first day at class to do a big feature to blast out on social media to say, hey, look, you know, even in this crazy era of college basketball, like, we got two hometown kids here who are fired up to be Memphis Tigers. Yep. By the way, like, they might turn out to be pretty decent players too. So, you know, those would be two that I would look at to say, like, yeah, I mean, the numbers weren't off the charts in terms of 3-point percentage last year, but, you know, limited sample size, young players going into a league that's very gettable, like, they could pop too. So, you know, those are two that really interest me. Because, like, you know, I think we know what Quante Berry is. We've seen him in the American. We think Zachary Davis is more of a defensive specialist type of guy. You know, but maybe Givens and Thedford can bring that perimeter pop.
Yep. Now, we had a mini freakout today in the LSU orbit. Did you get to see it? Did you get to see the message boards?
Well, I did see something about people thought Garrett Nussmeier might have been hurt, right?
Yeah, they thought his ACL was torn. But we got an update from Brian Kelly. He said that Garrett Nussmeier aggravated his patellar tendonitis that he's been dealing with in his knee. So we avoided the big issue. He says, you know, if he's ranking the severity, it's 1.5 out of 10. But, like, this story I know they opened the season up against Clemson at the end of the month, and, you know, you want to be as healthy as possible for that. But do you think we're making a big deal out of nothing here?
Yeah, maybe. I would say probably. I would say probably making a big deal out of nothing, because you're talking about, you got to like consider the context of a Heisman Trophy contender with a huge week one matchup. You know, people get some intel that he's not on the practice field. You're going to dig on that. And yeah, that could be really concerning and easily get blown out of proportion. So I would assume you're going to have a guy like Garrett Nussmeier on a pitch count, because did you see what happened with Anthony Richardson, you know, the other night?
When
you have key players getting hit in meaningless action, be that practice or preseason, Garrett Nussmeier doesn't need to go get 80 snaps with the ones in a scrimmage or in a practice. Like, we know who he is. He knows who he is. There's no need for that. So if there's anything to be even remotely cautious about health wise with a guy like Garrett Nussmeier, I don't fault LSU at all for playing it safe. Like, this man could just hang out in the film room for the next 3 weeks, roll him out there week one, and he's going to be fine. I don't read too much into this at all at LSU.
Yeah. I still like Garrett Nussmeier. I know that patellar tendonitis is more of like it's a pain tolerance thing. It's a pain tolerance. It's not really like a risk for further injury. I had a bunch of teammates who had some sort of similar issues. It just sort of comes and it goes. So I think we're making a big deal out of nothing. How do you think they're going to open up against Clemson? I think most people are going to pick the Clemson side of things, but we could learn a lot about LSU if they stick in that game and ultimately win it.
Yeah, we could. I mean, I'm pretty optimistic for it. Like, I would actually consider the LSU money line in that game. So I'm kind of high on LSU. I mean, I've told you, I've got LSU higher in my CBS Sports 136 ballot than my colleagues do. I was telling Jeffrey this yesterday, because we were going through SEC win totals. A lot of my optimism around LSU isn't necessarily offensive based. Like, we know how good the offense can be. We believe Garrett Nussmeier is good. He's got to cut down on turnovers, yada, yada. Where I think LSU is going to take another big step this year is defensively, because I think it's been proven now, especially at some of these more premier programs that have plenty of talent. It's year two under a new defensive coordinator when you really start to see the significant strides. And I thought LSU was better defensively last year. Now I think it's the year where they start to get a little bit salty, because like, they were better last year, but they weren't salty. I can see them being pretty nasty this year, or at least top 20. Like, that's all we're asking for, is be top 20, be a top 5 or 6 defense in the SEC. If you can do that, then I think you take a lot of pressure off of Garrett Nussmeier. He doesn't have to play hero ball as much. And then you sort of unlock that potential we've been waiting to see from LSU. So that's why I'm higher on LSU. I mean, how does that play out at Clemson? It's hard to trust Brian Kelly in week one. I mean, the track record there is so bad. What is he? He's 0-3. 0-3? Yeah, he's 0-3 in week one. And yep. Then they've lost in week one, even dating back to Ed Ogeron, to Ed O's tenure. So, I mean, I get it. Like, there's a lot of skepticism there about LSU in week one, but you know, I think they've got a pretty good chance. I'd really look at them hard on that money line.
Now, Pete Thamel wrote a story about Ole Miss quarterback Austin Simmons, about how he's composed even in this situation, how he's composed last year, and that drive he had against Georgia where he just walked the Ole Miss offense down the field. When Jackson Dart, before he got hurt in that game, was not able to do that. I have told you, if for no other reason besides the fact that Lane Kiffin didn't hit the portal and wanted Austin Simmons, I'm a believer. I'm buying stock in Austin Simmons. But that Ole Miss team in general, like, how much of a wild card are they? And what, like, when we look at sort of peaks of what they could be and valleys of what they could be, like, how big of a difference do you think that is, considering the schedule they're going to roll out against?
Well, that's an interesting question, putting it like that, because it's probably as wide of a potential variance as anyone in the league.
Right.
Because there's only one unwinnable game on the schedule. They're not going to win at Georgia. but they could absolutely win every other game. So 10-2 or 11-1 is the ceiling. But I'll be honest, I think the floor is probably 6-6. And I don't know how many other SEC teams you can say that about. Like, you can realistically say, oh, yeah, they could win 6 games or 10. I don't know. You know, most teams you can kind of peg it pretty easily and say, all right, well, unless they have a catastrophic run of injuries, they're going to be in this 3-win window. I think for Ole Miss, that window is a little bit larger than it is for most other teams in the conference because, yeah, of course, you're breaking it in a new quarterback with Austin Simmons, but also it's just the volume of transfers. And I think the skepticism around Ole Miss is basically that, okay, they have a highly rated transfer class. Again, we get it. Lane Kiffin is the portal king. But this year in this portal cycle, the consensus around the country is that the portal just wasn't as good, that a lot of other programs have gotten better at retaining the players they want to keep. So that the average quality of player that you're getting out of the transfer portal just isn't as high. And if that's the case, then – yeah, it's going to be closer to 7 or 8 wins for Ole Miss. But, you know, if Austin Simmons is a fringe all-SEC player at quarterback and the defense is able to kind of hang on after being so elite last year, the schedule is so manageable that 10 is in the realm of possibility there.
Yeah, is Tennessee, are they in a similar situation, though, too? Or are you not as high? Like the potential peak is not as high as Ole Miss's.
Yes, I would agree with that. I do think Tennessee's schedule is a little tougher, though. I mean, you do have Alabama and Georgia on there, and you do have to go to the Swamp, and you know Oklahoma is not an easy dub, and whatever. I mean, so
right.
and not to mention like Ole Miss. Like, they've got 9 games in the state of Mississippi. You know, I mean, that's insane.
Right.
Eight home games. So, awesome year to be a season ticket holder, you know. But, yeah, I think Tennessee's schedule is a little bit more difficult. And, you know, I guess it's an interesting question. Like, I guess my ceiling for Tennessee is 10. I just don't think it's all that likely. I mean, I would almost be willing to bet it's either going to be 8 or 9. For Tennessee. Like I feel pretty confident in that. Like I think the floor is higher than it is at Ole Miss, and I don't think the ceiling is quite as high. So I think they're more likely to fall in that 8 to 9 range.
All right, now final thing. Arch Manning, of course, is a big topic of conversation heading into the college football season. He is the favorite to win the Heisman at most sports books. But his grandfather, Archie Manning, was asked about if he has a good season, would he declare for the 2026 NFL draft? And he said, Arch isn't going to do that. He'll be at Texas. But let me pose this question. If he throws for 4,000 yards, wins a national title, and wins a Heisman, is there any chance that Archie is correct in his assumption at this moment? Because this was a very clear declarative statement. He is not going to declare for the 2026 NFL draft.
I mean, they're in lockstep on everything in that family. You know, if that wasn't the case, if that wasn't the truth, if there was a scenario where Arch Manning is in the draft next year, I don't think he would have said that. Like, I would believe him. I would take him at his word. Because, I mean, I think the thing we got to remember now is you can make money playing quarterback in college football. At a place like Texas, you can make a lot of money playing quarterback. You can probably make as much as you could as an NFL rookie. So, and then when you consider that Eli and Peyton, they stayed when they could have been first round draft picks as coming out after their junior seasons, and they weren't getting paid over the table, and they decided to stay and just live out that college experience. And so, if you can live out that college experience as a Manning while getting paid, I mean, it seems like a pretty cush gig to me. So, I would take Arch at his word.
Yeah.
Archie.
But I think that would be I think that would be a stupid decision. Still, if you meet the expectations that have been set, which is Heisman and national championship contender and potential national champion, if you reach those expectations, there's no guarantee you're going to be able to reach them the next year. Also, the injury conversation could be on the table. I don't care if he's Arch Manning or anybody else. Like, when you have an opportunity with your play at the college level to be a number one overall pick or to be a top five pick, it feels like you do that. Regardless of your situation, you have to strike while the iron's hot.
Yeah, but if you're already rich and you love college, like, you know, Peyton didn't need the money of the NFL. His dad was Archie Manning. He came back and had a great senior season. He would have been a top five pick coming out of it as a junior. The same logic applied there. I mean, your logic that you're applying is sound. Like, a lot of people probably thought that was a dumb decision. But, you know, he would have been a legend at Tennessee anyway. But he is a legend of all legends now. I mean, there's nobody like there's no greater celebrity, nor will there ever be a greater celebrity at the University of Tennessee than Peyton Manning. And not all of that, but some of that is due to the fact that he came back for a senior season. Like, if Arch Manning could replicate that at Texas and dethrone Matthew McConaughey, I mean, all right. Like, come on, like that's a pretty good gig, a pretty good life to have. So. I don't know. Like, I think the NFL will always be there. The NFL will always be there for Arch Manning. Even if he busts an ACL as a senior when he maybe could have turned pro, you know, it'll still be there. They're not going to need the money, and you get that college experience one time. So I'm not saying he's right or wrong, but it's not
about the money, David. And listen, I take Archie at his word. Like, I don't think Archie would say this if he didn't mean it. But, like, in the end of the day, I would ask – like, what are Arch's ultimate goals? Is it to be multiple-time national champion in college, or is it to be a high draft pick and a franchise quarterback in the NFL? Because that's where this particular, you know, conversation needs to go to. Like, what's your ultimate goal? If you're not going to come out after next year, even if you're phenomenal and you win a Heisman and you win a national championship, like, what do you think about the NFL? Like, how much do you have a hunger to be the franchise quarterback of an NFL franchise?
I just think that it's going to be there for him. Like, that's not even a topic of debate. If he's even close this season to what we think he's going to be, then yeah, like, he can play another year of college football and he'll be the number one pick in the 2027 draft, you know, and he'll have another good year with his buddies at Texas.
We've seen fall-offs, though. Let's not act like we haven't, from quarterbacks that are maybe not Mannings, but similar skill sets.
Well, I mean, sure, Quinn Ewers probably would have been drafted higher. Like I think Quinn Ewers is a good example.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have, like, a great recollection of what his stock was after the 2023 season, but he was draft eligible, could have come out, could have paved the way for Arch to play earlier, probably would have been drafted higher than he was. So, you know, I mean, yeah, you're not wrong about that. I just don't think those decisions are as cut and dry anymore. And it's not just for college football quarterbacks. It's for any player with eligibility remaining in college basketball or college football because of the amount of money that you can make in NIL in college. It's totally changed the game and the dynamics. And for a guy from that family who was already going to be prone to staying in college longer than most people would. Yeah, I mean, I think that it just makes it even easier to say, I'll stick around. And, you know, you think about it, like, how likely is it that Arch Manning leads Texas to a national title and also wins the Heisman Trophy? I mean, the odds of that happening, I mean, like, yes, it could happen. It's possible.
They're the shortest in the country. Right?
But
there's still 136 teams in college football. I get that.
Sure. So, I mean, I'll say, like, okay, yeah, if he wins the Heisman Trophy and guides Texas to a national championship, maybe they do revisit that conversation, because at that point you've exercised multiple generations worth of trauma for your family by winning a Heisman. You've won a national title. I mean, you've kind of accomplished the things that you set out to accomplish in college football that your uncles and your grandfather couldn't do. And, you know, maybe at that point it's like, all right, I beat this video game, time to go play a new one, you know? So I don't know, but I just think the likelihood of those things, of him accomplishing both those things, it's possible, but I wouldn't say it's likely. And so if he doesn't accomplish both of them, then there's still something left on the table for him to accomplish in 2026.
That's fair. Well, David, have a good weekend, man. I appreciate it. We'll talk again next week.
Okay, sounds good.
Yes, sir. He is David Cobb at David W. Cobb on X, college basketball, college football writer for CBS Sports. Also, make sure you catch him Monday, Wednesday, Friday with me, and then on Thursday with Jeffrey Wright and company right here at 92.9 FM ESPN. But we need to go ahead and get into a trip around the National Football League. We have some injuries to discuss, and we have a lot of preseason coming up. So make sure you stick around for that right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. Real quick, an update on the FedEx St. Jude Championship before we get into a trip around the National Football League. Play has been suspended for the day. Day two, or round two, will resume at 7:30 tomorrow morning, and then round three will begin at 9:50, split tees, and in groups of three. So play is suspended for the day due to inclement weather. Tommy Fleetwood in the lead, but they will resume tomorrow at 7:30. Now let's go ahead and get to a trip around the National Football League. Connor, hit it. Tom Brady's statue outside of Gillette Stadium has been revealed. And Connor, we need to review this thing. What do we think? I think they got the face right. The lack of muscle definition is fantastic. They needed to get that right. The only complaint I have, little thick in the midsection, little bit thick there. But I think otherwise, this is one of the better statues we've seen unveiled. You can really miss with statues, as we've seen in the past.
I give it a thumbs up. I think it's a good statue for Tom Brady. I like that they didn't make him jacked. It looks like Tom Brady. Yeah, maybe a little thick in the midsection, but overall, I would say it is better than most statues we see.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, his arms, he's got one raised in the air and one holding his helmet. They literally they did zero muscle definition. It's very accurate. It's a very, very good portrayal of Tom Brady in that regard. All right, so for the Indianapolis Colts, I already mentioned it, but Anthony Richardson was knocked out of last night's game after getting a hit from David Ojabo, the defensive end for the Ravens. He dislocated his pinky, his right pinky finger on his throwing hand, and it looks like he could be back at practice as soon as Saturday, but it's going to be a pain tolerance thing. This is according to Stephen Holder, the Colts reporter for ESPN, and Adam Schefter, of course, ESPN NFL insider. He needs as many reps as possible. He needs to get back out there and prove that he won't make that mistake again. So I hope he can get back on the field soon, but I hate to do this. I hate when guys get hurt, and my first reaction is, well, they kind of did it to themselves, because I don't want to see anybody get hurt, but that's how I feel about this situation. Oh, for the Miami Dolphins. Today was a very interesting day at joint practice with the Bears. Tua threw three picks, the Bears DBs. Not good. And the vibes aren't good around that franchise with the Tyreek Hill situation anyway. Alexander Mattison, who they brought in at running back, two fumbles. And then Mike McDaniel tried to pull a Mike Vrabel and hop in and break up a scrum. Break up a fight in practice. Mike, be careful. Self-preservation, brother. Sometimes you need to practice it. I know you saw Mike Vrabel the other day hop in and break up a fight and get a nice shiner on his cheek and he was bleeding. Mike Vrabel's a former NFL player. He played defensive end. He played in the trenches. He's nearly 6'5", 270 pounds. Still, he works out every day. Brother, you're maybe 5'7", 5'8", 160 pounds soaking wet. Don't ever do that again. I'm serious when I say, like, we've seen guys, like, swing helmets around, punches be thrown. Mike McDaniel put his life in danger today by jumping in the middle of all those NFL players. You're way too small to be doing that. Don't try to take lessons from Mike Vrabel. He's much bigger than you and much stronger than you. All right, so we asked the question yesterday in the response to Rashawn Slater, left tackle for the Chargers, his patellar tendon injury, and is in the rupture. He's going to be out for the year after signing that four-year, $113 million deal that made him the highest-paid offensive lineman in the history of the NFL. But we asked the question, how serious is a patellar tendon injury? And I, with my experience at the University of Memphis and just in general, I said, I think it's right up there with an Achilles. Now, Connor looked it up. He said an ACL is still considered more serious than a patellar tendon injury. But a recent study from the National Library of Medicine showed that 79% of NFL players who suffer a torn patellar tendon do not return to their previous form. And according to the study, 86% of the players who tore their patellar tendon did not return to start more games than they did before the injury, which is a big concern for Rashawn Slater. He's only 26. He's just now getting to his second contract. He's been an All-Pro. You want him to come back to full form, but history shows us that's not the case, and I hate to do this to Chargers fans. I really do. I know there's not that many in the listening area, but I know of one in particular that's friends with me and Connor that's probably out there listening right now. The last time the Chargers had a guy tear his patellar tendon, rupture his patellar tendon, was J.C. Jackson. They signed him over from the Patriots.
Oh, no.
For massive money.
Oh, no.
And it was one of the biggest flops in the history of that franchise when it came to outside free agents. So I don't mean to make both of these situations the same. I don't think they're the same. But J.C. Jackson was an All-Pro before he got to the Chargers. Torres patellar tendon was never the same. Rashawn Slater was an All-Pro before the patellar tendon injury. He's 26 years old. History does not serve guys who tear their patellar tendon very well.
I'm going to have to do a wellness check after you said that, just to make sure he's okay.
Yeah. I hate to drop that knowledge and to make that comparison, but it's...
Keenan Allen's back.
Yeah, Keenan Allen's back. Now, as far as what they're going to do to... And we talked about this yesterday a little bit. Didn't know the full-on particulars. As far as what they're going to do to reshape the line... with Rashawn Slater out, I think they'll still get by pretty well. Joe Alt is going to kick over to left tackle, and then Trey Pipkins, who started every game 2 years ago at right tackle for them before Joe Alt was on the team, he is going to be the right tackle. And he's a pretty highly paid backup right tackle, so I expect this offensive line to still have some semblance of normal. Oh, C.J. Gardner-Johnson, our favorite, my favorite guy ever. Originally, it was thought that he tore his ACL, but it looks like he has not torn his ACL. He was brought over in a trade from the Eagles this offseason to the Texans. Really good player, hothead, trash talker. It looks like he'll be back for week one, though. No ACL damage. They're going to do further testing, but it looks like he'll be okay. And I was just thinking, a season would not be the same without C.J. Gardner-Johnson on the field. Yeah, I know he's not really thought of by a lot of people when it comes to sort of faces of the NFL, but he always gives us some storylines throughout the year, some good quotes. He's fun to follow. Xavier McKinney, who was an All-Pro last year in his first year with the Green Bay Packers, who's actually the number two rated safety according to Pro Football Focus, he's down in camp. He has a calf injury. Looks like they expect him to be back for week one, but they're not completely sure about his status for week one. Let me ask you this, Connor. Packers this year. How do we feel about the Packers this year? That's a team that we have not really addressed on the show so far. Any takes?
About the Packers?
Yeah.
I think it's just like, can they sneak into the playoffs again? Like, No, I don't really think of the Packers that much. I feel like the Packers are a good football team who I just don't know if they have the personnel to be great or to really compete. They're in a tough, you know, the NFC North
And if the Bears come along, a lot of Let me ask you this. Let me ask it this way. And I don't know about the Vikings as well. Vikings could be the answer to this question. If the Bears take a step, if the Bears are a playoff caliber team, who is the team in the NFC North that we're immediately docking? Is it the Vikings or the Packers? I would probably lean Vikings with J.J. McCarthy.
I would say because I would probably lean Vikings because of the quarterback situation. Like, we have seen Jordan Love be a good quarterback in the NFL for a little bit. I guess my biggest take on the Packers would be, or the biggest thought, I suppose, is can they stay healthy for a season? Because it feels like The last season specifically, health really held that football team back with their wide receiver core specifically. Because remember, we had conversations, right, and we saw pieces going into the season last year where they were like, do the Green Bay Packers have the best wide receiver core in the NFL? And we were probably not.
Yeah,
but now they've added somebody like Matthew Golden to that. Yes. Like Josh Jacobs is a really interesting player for the Green Bay Packers. So I guess it's mostly if they stay healthy, they could make some noise, but last year they were just devastated by injuries, it felt like. And every single time they got it rolling, another injury would happen to one of their wide receivers or skill position guys.
They had 300-plus yard wide receivers last year, but Jaden Reed was hurt. Romeo Doubs got hurt for part of the year. Christian Watson was hurt. Dontavian Wicks was hurt. I think Matthew Golden adds a certain speed that wide receiver room needs.
Well, and like,
I think they have a deep wide receiver room. I don't know how good it is top end, though. Like, that's my problem. Like, even those declarations last year, I think they have a good wide receiver room. It's just not the normal wide receiver room where you have a certified wide receiver one, number two guy, number three guy on down the list. You just have a bunch of guys that pop in a given game.
And I suppose, can Caleb Love get back to the 2020?
Or Jordan Love
get back to the 2023 version of himself, because he was great in 2023, took a little bit of a step back last season, but again, I think a lot of it was the wide receivers that he was being dealt. Like, he was trying to do a lot with less skill than he had the season before. So, you know, I'm thinking Jordan Love, the health of the wide receiver core, and if the Bears make some sort of leap, is it going to be the Packers or is it going to be the Vikings that take a step back?
I think I lean Vikings
now. That division's going to be nuts.
I think I lean Vikings right now. But also, here's what's so bizarre about that division. I think we even see a step back from the Lions. It's
really
hard to imagine. They were phenomenal last year. They were the number one seed in the NFC, probably from a talent perspective. They are not replacing just OC and DC. They're replacing eight coaches. That is so hard to do. They have continuity from a roster standpoint and from a head coaching standpoint. But eight coaches? That's your whole staff. That's a lot of turnover. So I think we may even see a step back from the Lions. That division, though, to your point, it's going to be really fun to watch.
It's going to be it might be the most exciting division in football. Just there are a lot of storylines, a lot of good teams. Every single team is going to be good. It's just going to be
how good
and which
playoff good. Can you win? Can you
which
have
playoff come out on
success?
Top? Yeah.
Yep. We'll see. But that'll do it for a trip around the National Football League. We'll come back and wrap up hour number two with small talk on this Friday, right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN. And small talk is brought to you by Conway Services, reputable service available 7 days a week. Now, a bit of an update around the Cleveland Guardians gambling situation. Emmanuel Clase, their closer, has been suspended with paid leave. Luis Ortiz, one of their relief pitchers, has been suspended with paid leave because of gambling sort of flags on first pitches. We went through the stats, I think, last week. Emmanuel Clase, their closer, every first pitch of his ninth innings this year, his waste pitch percentage was up at about 17.5%. Every other pitch, it was down at 5%, and people were gambling on his pitches. But an update there, the Ohio gambling regulators are drafting a rule to ban certain types of micro bets, including on MLB first pitches. The proposed ban would be on specific events within games that are completely controlled by one player, not all player props, but those specific player props. I think this is the right decision. I said this when this whole, investigation came about. We should not be betting on balls and strikes. It's way too quick. It's way too much. There's way too much up in the air. And also, I think that just in general, when we're talking about the consumer and people that gamble, they could lose their behind pretty quickly betting balls and strikes if they get addicted to that. So I think this is the correct thing. I think a lot of people should adopt this, not just Ohio regulators.
Yeah, when this came out, the very first thing out of your mouth was they probably need to ban this specific bet because it can lead to situations like this. And it's got to be betting on balls and strikes, especially a first pitch, has to be like playing the slots or roulette or something. It's just, it is, to be honest, if you're betting on those, man,
1-800-GAMBLER.
Yeah, 1-800-GAMBLER. That is the number that you need to dial, especially if you're betting on, like, ninth inning, first pitch. That's nuts.
Yeah. But those types of bets are ridiculous. Like, also, can I just give you my injection of opinion here? Betting on odd-even point totals, betting on heads and tails at the Super Bowl, like...
That makes more sense because it's like if you're only doing it once a year on heads and tails, because that is kind of fun. Like, I think that can be fun. It's
once
the
a year,
every
sure.
night betting on
well,
and, pitch first pitch in
the,
an inning.
Have you seen Poly Market and like the new
no.
the new betting
no,
apps
I don't really
that have
pay
come
attention.
Out there? It's like offshore things. Poly Market's like the big one that does it. It's been out there in on social media in the ether for a while. But you can bet on anything. You can bet on who Tom Brady's next girlfriend's going to be. You can bet on if J-Lo's going to get married again or not after she said today that she's never going to get married. She's focused on herself. You can bet on anything under the sun now. And, like, the fact that there's just no regulation is terrible. It's ridiculous. It's terrifying. It's a weird space to be in.
Yeah, this is the right step, though. At least the step in the right direction.
Limit a little
bit. Is limit it a little bit. Because yes. individual players in these types of bets have all of the control. Because if a pitcher is involved in some sort of gambling conspiracy, he can just decide to throw a ball anytime he wants to. And to be honest, it's stealing money away from people who are betting on it. Even though we think that they probably shouldn't be, it's still taking money away from those people. It's a tricky situation. But yeah, I think if anything, this entire situation, if you are a gambler, would show me just stay away from balls and strikes. That's
correct.
Not where you need to be betting. Just stick to the overall game, maybe a home run over under for a certain player. There are plenty
also,
of things you can bet on in a baseball game other than first pitch ball.
Also, I don't want to lose sight of the fact if Emmanuel Clase and Luis Ortiz are guilty of what is being alleged, although I don't even think there's like crazy allegations on them yet. They're just doing a full-on investigation.
They got flagged.
But the fact that they're on paid leave should tell you something. If they're guilty of it, they deserve all the punishment in the world.
Agreed.
Probably lifetime ban.
Probably so.
I'm just going to be honest with you. Don't want to lose sight of that. I just think that that type of prop bet and even having it as a possibility opens yourself up for things like this, and this is a fine first step to trying to limit. I know I'm a little late to this, but the Jothries. What are your thoughts on the Jothries? I love them.
They're my favorite of the shoe so far.
I think they are the best Jaw that's been released.
Agreed.
I think they're absolutely phenomenal. And it basically takes the swoosh as the J, and then they put an A next to it.
They're great.
They're awesome. They're awesome. And I would imagine whatever awards are out there to be won for shoes and your own personal line, I'd imagine he'd be up for.
I think that I'll probably end up snagging a pair. I don't have Jaws yet, but if I'm going to get one, it will be the threes.
Yes, they are really, really nice. I do still think his logo, though, is sort of a little bit too much of a play off Kobe's logo. It's like got the same shape. It just says Ja. But at the same time, his shoes, I think he's 3 for 3, right? He's 3 for 3 compared to some of the other nonsense that gets put out.
Some of them are absolute nonsense that get put out. But yeah, I would say he's probably 3 for 3. Sure.
Yeah, like the Devin Booker ones. honestly, the Devin Booker shoes look like when you go to the Nike site, if you just went to the Nike site and just typed in like generic Nike shoe, that would be where you start your personalization. It would just be that blank shoe. That's what the Bookers look like. But Ja has done a good job with his line. There's no doubt about it. Now let's go ahead and grab a break on that note. And hour number 3 will be on the other side. We'll talk about Jaren changing his number. We'll get to Trey Young, De'Aaron Fox. We have a lot to discuss with Parker Fleming right here on the Gabe Kuhn Show, 92.9 FM ESPN.